from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny.
This is a man's world.
What does it mean in this day and age to be a man?
This is a man's world.
Many colleges teach women's studies. Now more are teaching men's studies. This is more than just a touchy-feely exercise to make guys talk about their emotions. Understanding masculinity and manhood could help with social issues like violence, fatherhood, gender equality, and overall wellness. In this hour, we'll meet some of the scholars exploring this field, consider how we teach manhood to future generations, and take your questions and thoughts. Modern-day masculinity, next on Forum, after this.
Like Noah made the ark. This is a man's, man's, man's world.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. When was the last time you talked with a man about what his manhood means to him? How often do you hear guys discussing things like body image, rites of passage, self-worth, sexuality, work-life balance, or just whether they measure up as a man? I know. Guys don't talk about these things. Or maybe we didn't. But we do now, including in deeper, more academic ways. Understanding how masculinity is evolving is at the heart of a new field called men's studies. In this hour of Forum, we'll explore some of the research on men in society today and consider what these changes mean for men and for everyone. Joining us by phone is Michael Kimmel, a professor of sociology at Stony Brook University. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. Professor Kimmel, welcome to Forum.
Nice to be with you, Josh.
Also on the line is Professor Chris Kilmartin of the University of Mary Washington. He is the co-author of the book, The Masculine Self. Professor Kilmartin, welcome.
Thank you.
And here with me in the studio is Ashanti Branch, the founding executive director of the Ever Forward Club, a support group helping Black and Latino males achieve their full potential. He is also the former assistant principal of Montero Middle School in Oakland. Ashanti Branch, good morning.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Michael Kimmel, let me start with you. What is men's studies? Is it basically the same focus and scope as women's studies, just with a different gender, or is there more to it than that?
Well, there's two answers to this. First of all, Josh, I want to say when you asked the question at the top of your show, saying, "Well, do men ever talk about this?" And you sort of hinted that it was, you know, hardly if ever. And I think guys are talking about it all the time.
Hey, Michael, you're breaking up on me. I want to put that same question to Chris Kilmartin while we clean up the phone line. Chris, can you tell us what is men's studies?
Well, men's studies is the study of men from a gender-aware perspective. You know, that gender is a cultural pressure to behave and experience ourselves in ways that the society defines as being appropriate for us. And but men's responses to that pressure are widely variable. So we are studying the gender, doing gendered analyses of some of these issues like health, mental health, aggression, all these kind of things, and trying to discern what role masculinity ideologies play in some of these issues. So, for instance, men die 5.5 years earlier on average than women do. We commit suicide 4 times more often. We commit 90% of violent crimes, even though, you know, the vast majority of men are not violent. The vast majority of people who are physically aggressive are boys and men. So it's the study from a gender aware perspective of some of these kinds of phenomena.
Michael Kimmel, how did this men's studies movement come about? Women's studies emerged with a very strong feminist ideology woven through it as society has kind of changed and broadened. What brought this new area of scholarship into being?
Well, I think women's studies did two things. It made women visible because they had been written out of history and great literature and all sorts of areas. And it also made gender visible, gender as a way of organizing society as an important part of our identity. And it's that second part that was really important to us as we began to construct masculinity studies, using, by the way, the same materials that we would use to, in any area of gender studies. We use critical race theory, queer theory, and feminist theory, because those are the theoretical traditions that gender studies has drawn on. So it comes out of an idea that making gender visible as a part of social organization, as part of our identity, also applies to men. And that most men don't think that gender is as important to them as women see it, but it is vitally important. We think about it a lot, but we don't think about it systematically. And that's what masculinity studies was designed to do.
Chris, give me an example of some of the things that this area of scholarship is beginning to investigate about men and manhood. What are you studying in class these days?
Well, what we're studying is, you know, how is masculinity socially constructed? What is the variability among that? You know, we talk about this kind of masculine pressure to behave and experience ourselves in certain ways, but individual responses to that pressure are widely variable. We all know that men who are emotional and women who are not, men who don't like sports and women who do, et cetera, et cetera. So some of that, a lot of my work has been on violence prevention and working with, for instance, gender-based violence where, we have been calling attention the last year especially to the plague of sexual assaults on our college campus and in the military, and most of them are being committed by a small group of men. And so what we're looking at is how do these men, you know, what kind of motivates these men to do these kinds of things, and how can other men help, because most men are good men, how they can help with kind of stepping in when things when they see dangerous attitudes in more sexually aggressive men.
Michael Kimmel, what about you? What's going on in your classrooms and research labs these days?
Well, the first thing is I'm a sociologist, and one of the things that we pay a tremendous amount of attention to is the differences among men. What it means to be a man depends entirely on your race, your class, your region, your age, your sexuality. I mean, think, Josh, of two American men. You just, in America, let alone other countries, think of one who's, let's say, 75 years old, gay, and lives in Chicago, and another who's 19 and white and heterosexual and lives on a farm maybe 100 miles outside of Chicago. Now, don't you think they'd have some different ideas about what masculinity means?
Completely different, I imagine, yeah.
Well, I would say a lot different, not completely, because I think they'd still have some things to talk about. You know, how about those Cubs, for example? my sense is that what we need to focus on is both the variations among men, all of the different ways in which different groups of men experience masculinity. And then, of course, and I mean, I'm an enormous fan of Ashanti's work as well. So the different ways in which different communities have different resources in which they have to construct their ideas of masculinity. So different groups of men are vulnerable to different kinds of pressures about proving and expressing masculinity. So that variation, that is one major area. Another major area is, of course, that most entry-level workers, both women and men, want the same things out of their working lives. They want to have good careers, and they want to be involved in their families. Most entry-level workers today, most male workers today, have the same profile. They want to be really great dads. They want to be really great parents. And we do not have any policies in our country that enable parents, let alone women, to be the kind of parents that they want to be. We are one of four countries that has no paid parental leave for anyone. You in San Francisco know this because you've actually bucked that trend.
Right.
This is a global scandal that we have none. The other three countries, by the way, are Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea. So it does seem to me that we need to figure out ways to develop policies to enable women and men to live the lives. This isn't imposing some big, heavy ideology on men.
Right.
This is seeing what men want and then trying to figure out the ways in which we can develop a policy that can answer those needs. So those are two other areas that we're talking about.
Ashanti got a big smile on his face when he said that you're a big fan of his work, so we should talk to him about that work. Ashanti Branch, tell us about the Ever Forward Club. How did it come about?
So I was in my first year teaching at San Lorenzo High School, and I realized that in my class there was a group of students, mostly African-American Latino males, who were failing my class. And they weren't failing because they weren't trying. Well, they weren't failing because they couldn't do the work. They were failing because they weren't even giving an effort. And I couldn't understand that. I was thinking, well, hey, you got a prepared teacher who's here all the time, on time, early, got food in my classroom. But they weren't connecting. And I was like, I became a teacher for them. And so what I realized was that there was something deeper. And so what I did, I invited them to lunch once a week. Well, the first meeting was like, let's come to have lunch. And they came, and I said, look, I don't know what's going on, but I need you to teach me how to be a better teacher, because somehow I'm not making it happen.
You needed them to teach you how to be a better teacher.
Yeah. Actually, I knew the math. Like, I had all the pedagogy of how to teach math, but they weren't learning from me. Like, so something I was doing, something in the way I was delivering, something was in the way. And from the conversations from them, it became really apparent for them that it wasn't cool to be smart at that school. So if I want to be cool and smart's not cool, I'm going to do everything not to look smart. And so we began just having discussions. It was really for me to learn, okay, so how do we help you be successful and still feel like you're cool, right? And still be cool, right? I think you're cool already, but my opinion doesn't matter, right? They're looking at their peers and how their peers right. see them. And so our work began providing them just extra tools for how do you deal with it when you get upset? Like, how do you deal when you get pissed off at a teacher? Instead of cursing the teacher out, like, maybe you just need a, can I get a time out? Can I get a break? And I think we just got to help our young men get more tools that they deal with so they don't become violent. So they don't, like, I think that our jail population is 90% men. And I tell our young men all the time, do you think men are just that much worse? But we don't have a safe place to talk about our real emotions. We can't be really human, you know?
So what kinds of things does your organization do?
So every 4 weeks, we meet with students in middle school and high school. We just started our middle school program. We meet weekly. And it's a safe place for young men to come and talk about every emotion that comes up for them. Like, this is a place that if you need to deal with some sadness, some pain, some shame, some guilt, like, this is a safe place to talk about it. Because if you don't have a place to, then you just kind of end up filling up your emotional capacity. And then what, somebody bumps into you, looks at you wrong, and then you explode on the person. And everyone says, oh, he was such a nice person. Well, he was, but he was not really himself. He couldn't ever deal with it.
Where do you meet?
So we meet at the schools. So our ideal program when
in
we
Oakland?
Started. So our program at Montera Middle School meets at Montera. There's a program at Arise High School in the Fruitvale District. And our other program is at the Reach Youth Center in San Lorenzo. So that's where it started, actually, in San Lorenzo.
I imagine you've seen, in your time as an educator and a mentor, a number. You've seen the way that boys kind of conceptually grow into men change quite a bit, especially in a school setting. What would you say is the biggest change that you've encountered along that line?
You know, I think being in middle school now, I realize that that age is so critical. That seventh grade, like 11, 12, like it's this identity idea of who I am and who I feel I want to be, but who also how people see me. So, you know, my family, I'm a certain way, right? Because they know me and I can just be whatever. But when I get to school, like everyone's like judging. Everywhere there's a judgment happening. And so for our young men, they're in this game, in this battle with each other of, man, I'm not cool enough. So if I got to be a little tougher, I got to act a little tougher, I got to take it out on somebody, right? And so usually the teachers become the easiest prey, right? Because the teachers can't touch you and they can't retaliate.
Not in public school.
Not in public school.
Not in public school,
right? Right. So at least from my school, right? So you may want to, right? But I think that what our students begin to do is they begin to act out in ways to say, oh, I'm gonna show some toughness here. And then we end up getting them, and they end up getting in trouble, and they get sent home, and then it becomes a cycle of not helping them get more education, but it becomes a cycle to the pipeline, prison pipeline.
We're discussing the growing field of men's studies and what it means to be a man today with Stony Brook Professor Michael Kimmel, Professor Chris Kilmartin of the University of Mary Washington, and Ashanti Branch of the Ever Forward Club. And we'd like to hear from you. What about being a man today do you wish we had a greater understanding of or a better cultural conversation about? Call us. The number is 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. The phones have already started to light up, which is awesome. So I would also suggest that you get in via email. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. Here are a few of the responses we've already gotten online. One listener wrote, "But we wish people better understood that being a man is a beautiful thing that should be celebrated." Timothy tweeted, "I wish people understood the constant encouragement of violence and discouragement of feminism and emotions." And Jonathan wrote, "I wish people understood how much being a man means actively working to remove any emotion outside of anger from the acceptable things for men to feel. While it is true that the other emotions are feminized, and that is a separate problem, the fact remains that they have been trained out of us by society, by both other men and women." Good comments all. Let's keep those coming as we continue our conversation. Chris Kilmartin, I wonder about the study of masculinity. I understand that social sciences are not all quantitative. A lot of them are just stories that need to be told, human experiences that can't be measured. But is it all just personal stories and such? Can you measure masculinity?
Oh, that would be a great question for my co-author, Andrew Smiler, who really knows about all this measurement stuff a lot better than I can. But yes, there are quite a few measures. There's a conformity to male role norms inventory. There's a gender role conflict and stress. There are masculinity ideology scales. There's a lot of quantitative work going on with the measurement of masculinity, and I think where we need to move to that is because we know that sometimes masculinity is more salient in certain kind of situations than in others. So I watched Jason Day win the PGA golf tournament yesterday, and as soon as he got the last putt close to the hole, he just started crying.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, I think, seen by most men and certainly most golf fans as being entirely acceptable because it was in the context of, you know, winning a major tournament, and yet if he were crying in another kind of setting, maybe that would be less acceptable or he would feel more reluctant to do so. So that's where we have to move now, is into more, not only in seeing masculinity as a personality construct, but seeing it as something that gets activated in certain situations and not in others. And I think where we're moving in psychology is to try and help men. This is almost a mantra of mine the last few years. It's very, very difficult to resist a pressure that you cannot name. And so what we're trying to do is help men, and women for that matter, understand these masculine social pressures. And once you can name them, then it puts you into position to resist them. And why would you want to resist them? You would want to resist them when conforming to them conflicts with an important life goal or value, or it causes harm to somebody.
Right, right.
But it's very, very difficult to resist them if you don't even understand what they're about.
Michael Kimmel, we're about to go to the phones in just a little bit, but let me get into some of the more specific topics. There's so much we could get into, but let's dive into a few of them. Let's talk about rites of passage. You know, boys mm-hmm. become men in a wide variety of ways, and the things that we consider hallmarks of manhood, of that ascension, vary greatly. What changes in that process are most intriguing you as a researcher?
Well, in the book that I did some years ago, Guyland, I looked at college-age men, ages 16 to 26, and I was particularly interested in those kinds of rites of passage and initiation rituals that take place on college campuses with military groups, athletes, or fraternities. And the thing that really interested me about them is that, you know, there are hundreds of cultures that have very elaborate initiation rites and rites of passage for young males to go through before they become, you know, sort of full members of the community. But there's one difference about those, every other culture that does them, and the United States college campus. And that is, in every other culture, it's the grown men who think of the ritual, think of the big test, who conceive of it, who plan it, who execute it, and who are there at the finish line saying, yes, you've made it, you're okay. When we do initiation rituals on college campuses, they are a parody of these real ones that actually take place. Why? Because they're done without any adult supervision at all. What you have on college campuses is 18-year-olds trying to prove their masculinity to 19-year-olds. And that doesn't work. It becomes kind of relentless over and over and over again. And so this idea that, you know, this is when, you know, when we do the initiation rituals on college campuses, that's when the fraternity advisor says, oh, you know, I can't know about this. Or when the athletic, when the coach says, oh, I'm not going to be on a recruiting trip. Or the military leader says, I need plausible deniability. Don't tell me what you're going to do. We need grown-ups to step up in these sorts of things. It is grown-ups who are dropping the ball, not young men themselves.
I want to play a quick clip from a documentary about boys and masculinity called The Mask We Live In. It's directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. This is a clip in which a dad talks about raising his young son as a single parent.
It's been very hard to play both roles as a mother and father for Jackson. I was taught that men are tough, they're strong. I spent a lot of nights crying because he did have feelings and I had to, you know, take care of that. And then one day it clicked. And it clicked because Jackson said to me, Daddy, I'm sensitive. And I was like, okay, okay. So then I started reading a lot, you know, doing Google searches on how to be sensitive and stuff like that. I started just asking him how he felt. Like, how do you feel? Why are you sad? Are you okay? He taught me how to be more in touch with my own emotions and in his as well. Like, he would cry. Sometimes I would cry with him. And I would tell him, Daddy wasn't allowed to cry growing up, but it's okay. If you need to cry, cry.
That's a clip from the documentary The Mask We Live In, directed by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. Ashanti, I'd like to get your reactions to that. But first, I want to go to the phones and take one quick call. 866-733-6786. Let's begin with Mary in Oakland. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. So my name is Mary. I'm both a parent to the age group that Ashanti works with. My son and daughter are 7th to 8th graders. And I'm also an Oakland Public School teacher who teaches 7th graders. And I have a question for Mr. Branch and the other gentleman. What are some strategies that we as parents and as teachers can use with our students, with the young people we come in contact with? Because it breaks my heart to see my own son act a certain way at home, and he's sweet and silly and emotional, and go out into the world and got a little more bass in his voice, and he acts very angry, and that frightens me. And I know that he's not going to just be at home, but he's going to be out in the world. And I can tell him one thing as his mom and a woman, but it's, I think, going to come down to dad and friends and
right.
male teachers, which we don't have very many of.
Right. Right. Hey, Mary, I hate to cut you short. We're coming up on a break, but I did want to put that question to Ashanti Branch before we run out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary. So one of the things that the documentary does, and I think a lot of people, more people need to see the documentary, The Mask You Live In. You can get information at therepresentationproject.org. But that documentary really brings a light to what the challenges society as a whole is creating for our young men. And I think that what we have to be able to do better about is some of the things that our young men have to do in public is for safety, is for protection. But we have to give them tools that they know how to do both sides of themselves. And that's what we try and do in Ever Forward.
You know what? We want to talk more about those tools. We're coming up on a break, so let's pause on that. We'll continue on the other side. We're going to continue our conversation on the growing field of men's studies and what it means to be a man today with Professor Chris Kilmartin of the University of Mary Washington, Ashanti Branch of the Ever Forward Club, and thanks to Stony Brook Professor Michael Kimmel for joining us in our first half. Professor Kimmel, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure, Josh.
I'm Joshua Johnson. We'll continue the conversation after the break. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're continuing our conversation on the growing field of men's studies and what it means to be a man today with Professor Chris Kilmartin of the University of Mary Washington and Ashanti Branch of the Ever Forward Club. We also want to hear from you. Feel free to call us, 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Ashanti Branch, let me let you finish answering the caller's question. You were talking about tools to help young men learn how to express themselves in a healthy way.
Absolutely. So, you know, through Ever Forward, we focus on four development areas: social, academic, community, and family. But for young men, like, they're going to need to have a multiple array of tools as they approach the world. You know, I grew up in Oakland, so there were certain tools I had to use walking from home to school. And so for our young men, we try and teach them, look, there's certain emotions you have to use at certain times. And so how do you be sincere? How do you be genuine? But if you're dealing with a lot of fear and a lot of pain. And so our tools for them is, like, when we come together and we meet in circles, it's a safe time to, like, just let it go. But you may not ever be able to, in your life, be able to express any of those emotions where you live, right? Maybe even your family doesn't allow you to express your full gamut of emotions, right? So we provide them safe places to know that those emotions, anger, sadness, fear, those are real. And you got to have a safe place of dealing with them.
Chris Kilmartin, this sounds like it goes to the heart of the issue with vulnerability and men, not having to wear your armor up all the time, but finding, navigating those spaces where you can just kind of open up and be vulnerable.
Right. And, you know, the center of this masculine pressure is the worst thing you can say to a little boy is that you run like or throw like or act like or dance like or look like a girl. And so boys get this message very early on that being feminine diminishes you and makes you less than. And so they start to avoid some of these very adaptive kinds of behaviors, like their ability to express their vulnerability and not just convert every vulnerable emotion into anger. I think one very healing thing for boys and men is to find out that their vulnerability that maybe they're not expressing is actually much more the rule than the exception. That my own research has been on men and college men and sexism, and it turns out, you know, when men tell, you know, derogatory jokes about women, or they call women by animal names or the names of their genitals, most college men find that offensive. But they overestimate the degree to which other men are accepting of those attitudes. And what they're basically, I say, it's just like laughing at a joke that you don't think is funny.
Right.
If I watched you laugh at it, I would think you thought it was funny, unless you let me in on your private reaction, which, as you may know, boys and men are not exactly famous for doing. So if we make a space where men can be honest with one another, such as what Ashanti is doing, and the Men of Strength clubs that are being run by Men Can Stop Rape in Washington, D.C., which is sounds like a similar after-school program, then we have boys like letting other boys and letting other men in on their inner lives, and then discovering I'm not all that different if I feel sad or vulnerable or anxious or any of those kinds of things.
Gotcha. Let's dive in with a few online comments. We got a bunch of people lined up on the phone. Glad to see it. And we're going to get to as many of your calls and emails as possible. One listener writes, teach boys to respect themselves and others. Teach them that to be a real man is not to abuse the weak, but to use their physical strength to be kind. Fabian tweets, wondering if this men do not talk about is an American issue. I'm Argentinian. And men talk about these topics all the time. David writes via email, I have tried to discuss with feminist friends who are women some of the gender issues that men face and how they are in some ways comparable and in some ways incomparable. I have repeatedly been told that the issues I discuss are at best unimportant, or at worst, actively taking attention away from women's issues, which should be the primary focus of gender equality discussions. How can I change my approach and dialogue to have a productive discussion on these topics? Chris Kilmartin, what do you think he could do?
Well, I think that there's something to be said for listening to women's voices, and men, you know, kind of historically have not done a very good job at that. And so, you know, that I would be like, well, help me understand that and learn how to listen just listen to women's voices. But most feminist-identified women actually have higher opinions of men than non-feminist-identified women. So to engage in a social movement, you have to believe two things. You have to believe that the current system is unfair, and you also have to believe that it's unstable, that it can change. And so I think a lot of feminist-identified women have a lot of faith in men. They think we can do better. And so I think that, that's got to be a part of the conversation. How can we, I mean, we have all this language around the opposite sex and the battle of the sexes, which is the most curious battle in the history of humankind, where 90% of the combatants are allegedly in love with and having children with the enemy.
Right.
And we have to, I don't think we're going to solve many of these problems until we start to see men and women as being on the same team. But we have these cultural ideologies of oppositionalism that we have to unpack and that we have to have conversations about.
Let's dive in on the phones again. 866-733-6786. Dory in Marin. Dory, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
Just this morning on your station and on TV, there was a story about a very prestigious prep school in the New England area. People who have gone there have names that are recognizable to most of us. The senior class there, the boys in the senior class, had a contest going, and this has been going on for about 10 years, to see which young man during his senior year could score, and I put that in quotes, with the greatest number of young women in the lower grades.
Yes,
of that prep school.
I know exactly what story you're talking about, yeah.
Okay, and the winner had the most scores. What does this say about how we're raising, educating, and preparing the young men who in particular are being trained, supposedly, to be leaders?
Right. Dory, that's a good question. Let me put that to Ashanti Branch.
Yeah, thank you for the comment. I think one of the challenges I think is that it's not society creating that type of competition. It's young men creating it within themselves. Well, I guess that's part of society, right? But I think that we all would not expect our young men to behave like that. You know, any parent who has a student at that school wouldn't expect their student to be a part of that competition. But the young men are doing it. And with the lack of men in the community who are saying, here is how we hold you accountable, here is what we expect of you, then the young men are left to figure it out for themselves. And they're also left to be excited for how they can create new things to prove their manhood. And I think that that's something that happens in many communities with a lack of enough leadership. And I think that rites of passage, something that Everforward really believes in, that rites of passage is really important, because if the older men, if the elders don't come and help train and teach the young men will figure it out for themselves and they'll try and train themselves. And that's why you end up with what Michael Kimmel said is 17-year-olds training the 15-year-olds how to be men. And that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Chris Kilmartin, I wonder what you would make of Dory's question. But I did want to point out the story that she's referring to has to do with St. Paul's School, which is a top private school in New Hampshire. It's the cover story on the Daily Beast right now. It's called When Bro Culture Becomes Rape Culture. It's their display story at the moment. Chris Kilmartin, what do you make of Dory's call?
Well, it's clear that nobody's really talking to these young men about their sexuality, and that you have and I haven't read the story yet, but that you have this kind of atmosphere that can only thrive with an atmosphere of secrecy. So the boys who are disapproving of this kind of stuff are not speaking up. They're not telling adults. As part of, and I don't intend to, you know, the adults are the ones who are ultimately responsible for this, but that nobody's talking with these boys clearly about what it means to be a man, and giving them guidance or talking about their sexuality, and it's part of a larger cultural issue that there's a kind of a culture of male sexuality as being predatory. And you can see this in, you know, like movies like Wedding Crashers, where men are trying to act like somebody whom they're not because they that women will not be sexual with them if they knew who they really were.
Right.
And this is very self-loathing, you know, kind of thing. And so men start to define themselves by their performances rather than by the kind of character that they have, because nobody's talking with them about how to be a man of character. And so I think it just points up the need for these boys to understand kind of what it means to be a man. And I absolutely agree with Ashanti. We have to have adult men who can step in and talk with them in ways that affirm who they are as human beings, and rather than to try and expect them to be machines.
Let's get to a few more online comments. Anna wrote us via email, "Thank you for having this conversation. As a woman, I'm tired of seeing men suffer because they feel like they can't be a full person. There are no feminine or masculine emotions. There are just emotions, and we all have them." John in Concord writes, "There's definitely a place for emotion and communication in male life, but physical activity of some kind is absolutely necessary for human emotional and mental health, and, although my opinion is biased, the need is especially acute for young men. However, opportunities for physical activity have been cut back over and over again, whether wood shop, auto shop, recess, niche competitive sports, etc. Practically all that's left are traditional high school sports, which are by definition exclusive and don't necessarily appeal to everyone or even most. So many young men are cut out of meaningful physical activity on a social setting." Ashanti, I wonder what you think about that. You know, little boys run around with nothing to do. They would run around in an empty room with no toys just to burn the energy out. And I think there's something to be said for the need as young men to just have a physical component to life.
Yeah, I think also that—
and to not be ashamed of that physical component.
Absolutely. And I think that is really important that educators, teachers know the differences how boys and girls learn, right? Young men, they have this testosterone burning in them, which makes them want to run, jump off things, run through things. And they're told to sit down, be quiet, and listen to me talk to you.
I want to go run through things.
I want to do something. And what they end up doing, they end up pushing the person next to them who falls out of their chair. And as a way to just get their bodies moving. And I think that, you know, Michael Gurion does a lot of writing about how boys and girls learn differently and brain science and how boys need to do a lot more moving. But our school settings aren't designed to help them be more successful. And so our work, you know, when we talk, when a young man gets sent out of my I was sent out of class or I'm, as a vice principal to my office. I'm like, what happened? Oh, I fell. I'm like, well, how did you fall? Well, he pushed me and I fell out of the seat. And I'm like, why did he push you? I don't know. And he realized that the conversation is like, you're in trouble. You got sent to my office and really you just need to go take a walking break. Maybe
right.
You just need to stand up, take a brain break, get off your behind and stand up and get some energy.
Run around, do something.
Run around, right? And I think that that's just a type of learning that we have to provide our educators as well, that we got to learn how to help our young men be successful.
Let's continue on the phones now with Will in Oakland. Will, good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Joshua. This is Dr. Will Courtney, and I'm so glad you're having this discussion. I'm a local psychotherapist specializing in working with men, and I'm also the author of Dying to Be Men. Hi, Michael, Chris, and Ashanti.
Hello, Will.
Good morning.
What's on your mind, Will?
I just want to note that this is not a new area of study. I began teaching the course on masculinity and men's health in 1999. But I want to address a question probably on many people's minds, and that's, why study masculinity? Haven't we always focused on men? And that is a question I heard, you know, 20 years ago when I was researching masculinity and men's health at UC Berkeley. People would ask, why men's health? Hasn't the study of health always been about men? And there was some truth to that. This was a time when the women's health movement had finally gone mainstream and people finally knew the fact that males represented the vast majority of subjects in health studies. So if we wanted to understand the side effects of the drug, we understood the effects on men, but we didn't know the effects on women. And that was a real problem for women's health. But we also didn't understand men and masculinity and understand men's health from a gendered perspective, and men as gendered beings.
Right.
So we didn't understand, for example, why men rarely saw doctors relative to women, and why when men did see doctors, why doctors spent far less time talking to them than they did with women. We didn't understand why men were dying younger and why men are less likely than women to follow prescribed regimens.
You know, Will, that's a good point. I want to put that point to – thank you for calling in with that. I want to put that point to Chris Kilmartin in terms of maybe any pushback that you've gotten in terms of even the validity of studying this at all.
Oh, yeah, I think that there's a great deal, and I think it comes from a place where, look, it's a man's world, and now you want to make it even more of a man's world by doing this. And I think some of that does, again, come out of this kind of oppositionalism that if we are for men, then we are against women. And I think that I do not think, and part of it comes out of a fear that women are going to lose even more power than they have already. And I think that's a legitimate fear. But power is not a zero-sum game. I mean, women can win as men when men win. Families do better, you know, when men are healthier, et cetera. So I think some of the skepticism is, I understand it completely. And so we have a kind of a big sell to do about men's studies. And, you know, as Will points out, men's studies is not new. I've been writing The Masculine Self is now in its fifth edition. The first edition, I think, 1993 or 1994. We've been at this for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But it's been very, very difficult to get the attention of the mainstream because in a lot of cases, I think that people think that men's experiences really don't matter, that men are about what men do rather than what men think or experience.
Let's get back to a few more listener comments. Divya wrote us via email, "I'm a woman engineer in Silicon Valley, and my husband is an engineer too. I wonder if your guests have any studies on what it is to be a man in technology. There's a lot of conversation around women in technology, but it seems like men have issues too, like being expected to work all the time, being the next millionaire startup guy, etc. It seems like no one talks about those expectations." Back to the phones now with Charles in San Francisco. Charles, good morning.
Good morning. My thoughts have changed as I've listened to some of the comments, but my original point, and I'll stick with it, is that I think this whole rubric of men's studies is not going to have a whole lot of validity unless it goes beyond an American-centric take on masculinity. And as I told the screener, you know, I spend a lot of time. I am myself part Asian. I spend a lot of time in China, Japan, and India. And the definition of masculinity in those cultures is completely different. You see it in something as simple as the fact that in high schools and colleges there, nerdy guys are popular. They're not scorned. They're not shunned. These are not cultures where men are necessarily very open about their feelings. But brutality and violence are not part of the masculine equation in those cultures. And I think we need to look at that. This is not inherent.
Right. Charles, that's a very good point. Thanks very much for calling in with that. Let me shift gears a little bit before we go to more calls and emails. I want to revisit this kind of image that the caller who just spoke to us brought up a little bit in terms of the imagery we put around men, specifically, you know, body image. I mean, if you look at athletes over time, they're bigger than they used to be. If you look at superheroes over time, because every little boy has had a superhero that he wanted to grow up to be, they're bigger now than they used to be. If you look at action figures, they're bigger and they're proportioned differently, where they're much harder for a human being to attain. So it seems like these idealized images are saying something about us. Ashanti Branch, I don't know if you've noticed this in terms of the images that boys are comparing themselves to, but they're, I mean, I can't really talk because I grew up wanting to be, you know, the Hulk. And when I realized I couldn't, I was like, Captain America? No? Okay, fine. And that drove me into the gym as an adult. So I can't really, you know, look down. But it seems like the images that boys are growing up with now are so much more unattainable and so much more enticing than the images I grew up with.
Yeah. You know, through The Mask You Live In, the documentary, they do a lot of, it's an exploration of American masculinity. And I think that there's a lot of work in there by Common Sense Media as well around what is happening in the world, right? What are we seeing on TV? What are the images our young men are seeing all the time? What are the video games doing? How are we showing our young men what it looks like to be a healthy, you know, productive man. And I think that that image is huge. Like if you have a young man who is sitting in front of a video game for 5, 10, 20 hours a week, and all he's doing is shoot him up, right? Then you expect him to somehow be calm when a situation happens to him. Well, it's all ingrained. It becomes like things that are a part of your thinking regularly. And I think that for, you know, young men who are maybe in middle school when they don't have their growth spurt yet and they're shorter than everyone else, they end up having to figure out, okay, well, if I'm not going to be as tall as them, then I got to be even more out of bounds than them, right? So I'm going to act even more over the top because I got to make up for these
compensations.
These compensations, right?
Yeah. One of our listeners writes, "I used to volunteer mentoring boys, but being a single queer male, I had to stop because it was too risky. I've heard so many horror stories about men being suspected of or accused of child abuse simply because it's considered suspicious for a man to be interested in kids. This is especially true of any man that shows any affection. Chris Kilmartin, I feel like there's a whole separate show to be done about masculinity among gay, bisexual, and transgender men. When you layer sexual orientation and gender identity into this equation of mentorship, it sounds like it makes things infinitely more complicated, but also just as crucial to the developmental experience, if not even more so.
Yeah, and no doubt about it. And I want to echo what the caller says. There's so much work to be done on internationalizing this study. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago at the convention of the American Psychological Association, the division I'm involved in, which is the Society for the Psychological Study of Men and Masculinity, had a conversation hour about how do we internationalize the psychology of men. There's a great deal of work, really, in feminist theory about what you're describing, which is generally termed intersectionality. So what happens when these gender pressures intersect with other forms of identity, such as ethnic identities or, kind of citizenship or sexualities, et cetera. And there's some of that work is ongoing. There just needs to be a whole lot more of it. On the other hand, and I think when I talk about masculinities, I talk about in both in the frame of continuity and change at the same time. So I think that homophobia is, it's alive and well, and I think it's grounded in anti-femininity. That's oversimplification, but there's really what can be more feminine than loving a man. But then you look at the almost breakneck speed with which same-sex marriage has come to be accepted, and that we have a great deal of social change around those attitudes toward gay men over the last decade, and certainly other sexualities as well. And so that tells you that something is happening, and maybe the Boy Scouts are now accepting, I believe, gay scout leaders, et cetera. And so people are as people get to meet as more gay men and come out, and people understand that they're all different, and that they're people, most importantly. Then we move toward greater acceptance.
Yeah, I've heard it said that. I've heard it said that homophobia is the fear that gay men will treat you the way that you treat women.
Right. Yes. I mean, I believe it's also grounded in the belief that male sexuality is predatory in nature.
Right. Let's continue on the phones. I hate to cut you short. We're just running out of time for the hour, and I want to get to a few more phone calls and emails. Let's go to Mariah in Berkeley. Mariah, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling. I study animal behavior, and I was recently in South Africa looking at elephants and talking to people that work with herds of elephants. And they actually have a problem where if a group of adolescent elephants are on their own and they're all males, they'll be infinitely more destructive than if there's an older bull, male elephant, in the group leading them and showing them how to elephant, so to speak, how to be a male elephant and not destroy everything. So I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about the rituals of masculinity in college and things like that, which there's parallels in elephants.
Mariah, thanks for calling in with it. That's kind of an interesting metaphor. Ashanti, I know you're not a zoologist, but I wonder if you see the parallel between the way that young men behave around you one-on-one as opposed to when they're in a group with their fellas, and how that kind of maybe gives them a mob mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. And when a young man is, when we're having a one-on-one and we're having a really deep conversation and they hit a spot where they don't expect to go, usually it makes it harder for them when they are back in the public, right? Because then they're like, wait a minute, he knows something about me that I didn't expect to tell him. And so they usually have to one-up me, right? But I always get it. I get where they're coming from, and I get that it's a protection. It's like, you're safe with me, man. Whatever happened in our conversation is safe. And I think a lot of them aren't used to having to have confidential, safe conversations with anybody. So they're always worried about anything coming back and confronting them, right? And so I think that that's a huge thing.
Running out of time in the hour, but Chris Kilmartin, I wonder what you would say is the next frontier for your research. Where would you like to see men's studies go, briefly?
Well, I mean, men's studies is very broad, and it includes many of the topics that we've already discussed, even down, I like the pachyderm mentoring kind of thing. You know, Franz de Waal, who's probably the most famous primatologist in the world, talks about alpha male. You know, the alpha male, is the stereotype is it's a bully, and some of them are, but if they are, they get overthrown
because
other animals form coalitions. So actually, the most successful alphas are populous. They're loved by their troops. And so there is even some animal models of a positive side of being a male. I would like to see some of the themes that we've already discussed. I'd like to see more internationalization. I would like to see more intersectionality. I would like to see more some of the work that we've been doing in sexual violence and sexual harassment prevention, in the military and on college campuses, that where we are starting to learn what works, and we need to have the will to and the resources to implement it.
And briefly, Ashanti, how can people get in touch with Ever Forward Club?
So we're at everforwardclub.org. And, you know, the representationproject.org, also everyone can take a pledge on how we can support more young men and boys and do some things that are supportive of them growing.
That's Ashanti Branch of the Ever Forward Club. Ashanti, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me, Josh.
And Professor Chris Kilmartin of the University of Mary Washington. Professor, thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. Mama taught him that. I got a good
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.